Hello and welcome to the Righteous and Rebel podcast, as truthful as resources permit. My name is Jimmy, and I've forgotten what we're saying right now. We've been in lockdown for some time, I think.
Well, we're well into second month, right? And hello, my name is Jazza, and I actually broke government lockdown rules this weekend,
You're
Jimmy.
You're supposed to tell the kids that, Jazza.
Well, let me tell you what happened. So, it was my birthday yesterday. I turned 31. Yes, thank you, I know I do look 24, that's correct. And my parents, both of them, came up from Essex, drove, because we were now allowed to kind of like drive to other places. They drove about the 20-minute drive to my flat, sat down on the grass, like 3 meters away from my rug where I sat down on, and we had a distanced picnic on my birthday. Now, Matt Hancock would say that I'm not allowed to do that, because I have to see each of them one at a time in 10-minute intervals. But I haven't been able to find any evidence that what we did is any different in terms of spreading, potential spreading of the virus. So we decided to do it. After much deliberation, obviously. So that's how I spent my rebellious weekend.
What Matt Hancock wanted you to do was for your family to get out of the car one by one, chat to
yes.
you, get back in the car, wait for
yes.
10 minutes, and then another one emerges from the car.
Yes.
Right.
And you understand why we decided not to do that.
Yeah, because it is bonkers.
Yeah. As Philip Schofield quite beautifully said on TV.
Well, I feel like there's I've definitely seen more groups of people who I don't necessarily think are from the same household hanging out with one another. I'm particularly thinking of groups of kids who, you know, large groups
yeah,
of kids.
Yeah, I'm like the 15 children altogether.
Yeah,
you don't all have,
yeah.
You're not in the same house, are you, mate?
I don't think so. So I do get a general sense that people are kind of breaking the rules a little bit more. But in a way, that's what the government wants, right? They want us to.
It seems like
chill
it, doesn't
out a little
it?
Bit.
Despite the fact that even before they changed the lockdown rules to oh goodness gracious, Jimmy, I hope you're staying alert. Are you alert?
I mean, as alert as I ever was, I think.
Excellent. I was awake all night last night, just staying alert. It's quite impractical, really.
I mean,
the infection rate actually increased a little bit. It's still supposedly below one across the UK, but it increased to potentially a height of 0.9 even before they changed those lockdown rules, which does not bode well, really.
Jazza, I don't remember if you remember asking me to do this, but do you have any suggestions of patriotic songs that children could sing, potentially when they go back to school on June 1st?
I think the most patriotic song is probably "Wannabe" by the Spice Girls.
Okay, could you do a rendition of that for us right now?
No.
I was asking you this because there was news that emerged not too recently, but there's a school called the Michaela School that actually makes pupils sing patriotic songs to
God, bloody hell, what are we, America? Jesus Christ.
I mean, my personal pick would probably be Three Lions, although that doesn't really work anywhere else other than England.
Oh no, Jimmy, it's got to be Vindaloo.
Again, I mean, isn't that more of an English thing?
It is more of an English thing. It's a very English thing, but it's also intersectional because it celebrates the multicultural cuisine in the form of curry, and that's all I've got.
I guess it does bring people together in that way. So yeah, we are going to be talking about the government's plans to bring back schools potentially on June 1st, although there's been a fair bit of pushback against
it. It's the earliest of June 1st, right?
At the earliest, and it's only several years. Broadly speaking, Jazzy, are you pro or anti sending the kids to their deaths?
Well, the kids probably aren't going to die. Like, right. There have been minimal, like a tiny, tiny number of deaths, both in the UK and globally, like literally count on one hand, from COVID-19 of children So it isn't the kids that are the that are potentially at risk here. It is all of the people surrounded by the kids, including their family members and teachers. And I specifically want to talk about the Daily Mail front page on Friday, which asked for teachers asked for us to let teachers be heroes, which conjured up images of them throwing themselves into the front line of the battlefield and dying. But we'll talk about that more later.
We will do indeed. Speaking of people throwing themselves into the front line,
Jimmy.
Keir Starmer has been delivering what at least some people have found to be an impressive performance or series of impressive performances at Prime Minister's Questions in the virtual House of Commons, I suppose you would say. We're going to be talking about his performance, how we feel he's doing. I think this was something we touched on in an episode or two ago. Jazz, how are you feeling about Sir Keir, to give him his proper title?
Sir Keir, whose parents own £500,000 house and £10 million worth of land.
Well, I think they're dead now, actually.
Oh, are they? Well, he's inherited some stuff and apparently now he's posh. So he is quite posh, but I don't think that probably... Like, when you compare him to bloody Boris Johnson.
Well, I think there's a dispute about how posh he is, or not, as the case may be, which I suppose we can go into. But the story you're referring to is a Mail story, that he bought up this chunk of land for his mum to run a donkey sanctuary on. And it's now...
That's quite cute, isn't it? Isn't that endearing?
I think that is quite endearing.
Oh my god, he's so dreamy. Jimmy, I'm sorry, I'm swooning. He's got such a chin on him as well.
I think in a previous episode you downplayed how attractive his chin was. So I don't think I can let you walk that
way. I'll be honest, it's my birthday weekend. I've had a glass of wine, I'm weaker.
Weaker at the knees.
Weaker at the knees for a man with a strong jaw.
Speaking of the quality of physical attraction,
Jimmy, Jesus, they're getting worse, these segues.
Sorry, if you spot an opening, you have to go for it. We are going to be talking about the pop singer Adele's weight loss, which is now a slightly old topic, but it's been a while since we did one of these, so.
Yeah, two men talking about a woman's appearance on the internet. What could go wrong?
One of whom doesn't even fancy women, so really doesn't have any skin.
That makes it okay?
It's hard to say. I think my opinion was disqualified about the attractiveness of, I can't remember who it was, Keir Starmer probably, on the grounds that I wasn't actually attracted to men, which seemed a bit unsporting from my point of view.
Unsporting, but I think totally fair. Are you going to be the person with the sole opinion about Adele's weight loss this time then?
Probably not.
I feel like that's also equally unfair.
Well, I don't think you'd let something like your non-straightness hold you back on a topic like this, Jazza.
My non-straightness. That's incredibly inclusive of you. I am gay. You can say that.
Okay, shall we go to the bit where we ask people for generous donations, or ungenerous ones even?
any of them, really.
Overall, and then go on to the main podcast.
Yeah.
Okay. If you like what we do at the Right Dishonourable podcast, you can support us by going to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. It's a fairly conventional Patreon account, and I'm sure most of you know how that works, so I won't bore you with any further details. A big thank you to our existing patrons, Alexander Wood, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, David Warner, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt, and Ollie McGregor.
Jimmy, am I being melodramatic when I read the Daily Mail front page headline, which asked that we let teachers be heroes, in reading it as suggesting that we should put teachers in harm's way and maybe kill them with our children?
Well, you know, I find that teachers talk a big game about being a vital element of society, and I think the Daily Mail was just calling them up on it and saying, well, you know, step up.
Really?
I don't know. I'm being facetious, but I do find
thank God
the slight reversal of I mean, is it a reversal? I guess you could ask, but like, it's normally like other, you know, it's the left wing who bigs up teachers and says how important they are and how heroic they are and how we should pay them more money, etc. And this time, I don't think that, you know, the Mail is calling for more money to be paid to teachers, but I think the rest of it, they were saying, you know, teachers are heroes. You should go forth and teach children in that vitally important last half term of the year.
I didn't believe. I read the article. And I didn't believe a word. Like, I don't think there was sincerity in very much of the word. And I think actually your initial response of, "Well, all we're doing is highlighting how important you've always said you are, and giving you a chance to show that importance." I thought it was really quite patronizing, actually. And I think there are legitimate concerns if you are a teacher. Especially if you're a teacher who's from maybe a vulnerable, immunocompromised, or somebody who's from a vulnerable demographic, for example,
So we should probably
like
say,
they're rightfully potentially concerned, right?
we should probably say what the plans are that have been put forward so far. And these received significant pushback from the teaching unions and the British Medical Association, I think it's called. So neither the doctors nor the teachers are particularly in favour of these plans, seemingly. But the British government wants in England schools to open from the 1st of June. It would include nursery and preschool years and also reception years 1, years 6 at primary school, and at secondary school it would be years 10 and 12. So it's largely like the most significant years, basically.
Otherwise, none of the years would go back until at the earliest September this year.
And it's worth noting that schools in Wales are not going to open on the 1st of June, and Scotland and Northern Ireland are still mulling their options, as it were. But it's only really England, English schools, that are being expected to do this at this stage. I mean, I think you're right. There are clearly risks with reopening the schools, but I mean, given that, say, construction workers have already been encouraged to go back to work, manufacturers have been encouraged to go back to work, is there a particularly good reason why schools and teachers should be exempt from this, do you think?
I've heard a lot of representatives from the profession and from unions express, especially with younger kids, the how difficult it is to practice social distancing within schools, especially with the young kids in reception and kind of like year one, who are those who are most likely to go back first if they do go back. Whereas at least on a construction site, you are able to adhere to certain amounts of social distancing. You can enforce an adult, like a 2 meter radius around everybody, and then it's kind of like their decision whether or not to do that. But a 5-year-old isn't going to understand necessarily and isn't going to partake in that. If you try and get a group of 5-year-olds together and tell them to not touch each other and lick each other's eyeballs, then they're not going to be very good at that, are they?
Well, I mean, even if you just walk around your average park, I've noticed that children are not definitely not adhering to social distancing rules.
Yeah,
So if you get a group of
exactly.
them, it's not going to pan out well, I don't think.
Yeah, exactly. And so that I think is one of the major reasons why it's different. I will play devil's advocate to my own kind of like visceral response to this, which is you need to make sure that this is as safe as possible. We know very well how severely not being in formal education affects children long term, not just over the terms of them not being in school. We've seen in situations like after natural disasters where schools have been closed for several months while they've been rebuilt, and also in other pandemics where there have been extended periods of lockdown of schools specifically, the effect that that has had on the younger populations. And now this is probably something that's going to affect a wider population, but there's also a huge amount of differentiation at the moment with the quality of the teaching that children are getting, even more so than we usually get in kind of like our weird public-private systems that we have in the UK anyway. I read a stat that something like 50% of private schools are offering online classes from 9 till 3, whereas only 10% of state schools are. And that is kind of like a representation of the resources that are available based on whether or not your parents are able to pay tuition fees or whether or not you have a scholarship or anything along those lines.
Well, my sense is that parents who send their kids to private schools are probably a little bit more uppity when it comes to demanding that they're getting teaching during the lockdown period.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's necessary. I think it's also access to resources and access to time to be able to train up staff and all of those kinds of, like, it's several things that are going to compound that. But if they have more resources when it comes to money, then of course they're going to, the private schools are going to be doing better, and they do, they have more resources. And so it's important that we get kids back in schools as soon as possible. I find it really interesting that the main reason given for wanting to get kids back to school so quickly is so that their parents can go back to work. And I understand that, because you need the economy to start working properly again, right? But actually, I don't think the main reason that people aren't going to work is because they have kids at home. It's because there's a bloody pandemic everywhere. That's why people aren't going to fucking work. Anyway.
Well, it is a bit bemusing to have such an emphasis on sending kids to school when... I mean, is it true that most people are still working from home? I'm saying this as a white collar
worker. Well, it depends. Like, we're in industries where most of the people that we know are working from home, and most of the people that we know probably are also working from home. Anyone who has any kind of like
real job,
what has weirdly started being called the front line, which is a bit too warlike for me, but you know, it's what we're calling it. People who are in kind of like face-to-face customer service or construction or in manual labor, like, or in skilled labor, or like all of those are people who have been affected by this,
right? But I mean, it still remains the case that actually, you know, needing to send kids to school would be more pressing if, you know, the more people that are going back to work, I guess.
Yes, that I think that's probably an accurate assessment. Well, because some of the schools have been, most schools have, actually, I don't know how many schools, some of them,
a portion of schools, several schools,
a number, an undetermined number of schools. I'm gonna put my hands up and say, when I don't know the bloody numbers, they've still been running classes for kids of key workers, which have mainly been like medical staff, people who work in in shops and stuff like that, and those who are deemed as key workers, journalists as well. I remember
journalists are key workers.
Yeah, you're a key worker, Jimmy.
I mean, I think the defense industry would be okay if the information was not published for a few months. I think they would survive. I'm gonna throw it out there.
Well, look forward to that letter in your inbox tomorrow, Jimmy. Of sorry, you've been furloughed.
I would have fixed home contract, mate. I don't care. I want to actually pull back to something you said previously, which is as safe, you wanted it to be as safe as possible for teachers and pupils to go back to school. But the safest possible thing is for them to not go back to school. I mean, that's
yeah, and wait
be
for
true.
A vaccine. But the like everything, it's nuanced.
It is.
There's going to be losses and gains, whichever choice is made. And I don't think that honest conversation is being had in the... Like, there's something... I don't want to be melodramatic, but there's something really broken about the rhetoric and the way that we discuss things in this country. They are extreme and they are absolutist. And there's no nuanced
you don't
debate.
Say. Crazy.
Oh, shut up.
These are some new opinions.
Yeah,
I've
whatever.
Not heard before.
But the fact that you can't say that there's no absolute winner and there's no absolute correct way of doing this. If you wait until there's a vaccine, those kids are going to be held back in terms of their achievements and their academic achievements for the rest of their lives. Whereas if you put them back too soon, that's going to put people's lives at risk. It's lose-lose or win-win. And we're not being told that. We're being told it's that there's no way in hell that teachers should go back to work because everyone's going to die. Or Or it's their duty to go back as kind of like pillars of our society, and if they don't, they're being unpatriotic. It's all very disappointing all around, to be honest.
Well,
what do you think they should do? You're very good at skirting these direct questions of mine.
Well, I mean, notwithstanding that, I'm sure very credible research that you cited about kids missing out on school and it damaging their development. I sort of think a lot of school is not that useful anyway, so actually missing out on a couple of months probably doesn't make that much difference.
Unfortunately, Jimmy, I know you're not going to like this, but the more school that children miss, the worse they do academically.
I mean, that's a sort of self-referencing test, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but unfortunately that is how an awful lot of one's ability to succeed as an adult is determined, is by how well you did at school.
You know,
maybe it shouldn't be like that. I don't think
I sort of think that's the problem, really. This is more an anti-credential
This is a chance for us to build a school-free utopia, Jimmy.
Well, I mean, you know, people have survived for, I don't know how long it's been, 2 months without schools. Maybe just keep going would be my advice. Okay. Non-facetiously. I think it is very tough, because actually the thing is about the teacher unions is that they sort of claim, I think implicitly, sometimes explicitly, that they're on the side of the pupils, but teaching unions are funded by teachers. They act on behalf of teachers. The teachers are the people they look out for. And it doesn't really matter for teachers whether they go back to school or not. I mean, you know, they're still getting paid, I think, at the full rates rather than the furloughed rates of some other workers.
It does depend on what type of teacher you are.
Right. And yeah, I mean, it is going to be bad for some pupils, but at the end of the day, you know, the pupils they move on at the end of the year. Do you know what I mean? So it kind of, from their point of view, I'm not saying teachers don't care about their pupils, but they're not really the ones taking the hit in this instance. So there's a question about costs and who's paying them for them.
What about the safety of the teachers? Is that not a hit?
Yeah, I would say so.
And also, I mean, there's also kind of like, if you zoom out, there's the wider thing of the potential spreading of the virus. We don't know how efficiently young kids can pass the virus between one another and then on to adults. There isn't enough data to support any conclusions there.
I think I'm right in saying that some countries in continental Europe have actually opened schools and then been forced to close them again.
Yes,
I want to say it's
but true. Some of them have never closed them. I mean, right. Somewhere like Sweden has been going for the herd immunity tactic.
I think
nothing
Sweden
really has
closed
there.
Their primary schools, though. I think it was only.
Oh, did they?
It was one. Oh, they either closed the primaries or the secondaries and left the other one open. It would be good if I knew which one it was.
That would be great
if I was running a political podcast.
That's yeah, you would have done your research if you were doing that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but you know, this is largely based on half-remembered articles I read last week.
Exactly.
The podcast in general, not just this topic. I'm kind of undecided, really, but as someone who doesn't have any kids, admittedly my sister's a teacher, so I have that skin in the game, but she seems pretty, you know, okay with the idea of going back to school, so whatever. I don't think the government has really earned the trust of the middle class professionals. Probably it never really had the trust of those groups of people. And since those people are teachers, teachers are by and large those kind of people, they're not going to trust the government on this, I don't think. I think a lot of what is posturing as like following the science, this is on both sides really, is really just a question of like, do you trust the blue team or the red team?
I hate, and there's been plenty of think pieces about this, I hate the whole phrase of following the science, following the science implies that there is an absolute truth. And when we are in a pandemic where we are still learning stuff about the virus every single blooming day, there is no absolute truths. There is only nuance. We're living in the grey. And the science that you follow could be right or could be bad. The decisions that you make at the out of these conclusions could be, like, will inevitably have positives and negatives that are then determined further down the line. The whole thing of following the science implies that, oh, we're doing the absolute right thing. And there's nothing that's going to be the absolute right thing. And I wish that we were taught that about science at a younger age, to be completely bloody honest. But anyway, I'm not dictator of the world yet.
If only people went back to school and learnt about science from some sort of qualified professional.
What is your stance on this, Jimmy?
I don't really have a stance, you know. I'm not, as I said, I don't.
You
really
never have a stance.
That's the safest position. Do you know? Like, it's. I can never be wrong if I never make a confident prediction or commit to an opinion about things.
I'm glad you finally admitted this.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is that I think the trouble is, like, this is sort of expands on your point, is that even if we knew a lot more about COVID-19 than we currently do, you would still be weighing all those costs. Like, you know, the cost of, like, there doesn't seem to be a risk to children, but maybe, you know, there's probably some sort of risk to adults, even if you knew those in quantifiable terms. You know, you're still weighing a kid's education versus the risk that someone's going to catch COVID-19 and die. Which of those things is more valuable? How much teaching is worth one death of one teacher? No one knows. That's why you have politics, is because people need to make judgments on those things, and people are going to disagree about those judgments.
And we should kill all of the teachers because they don't vote Tory.
I think that's a major that is a major thing in all of this, and that is, you know, that's why you have.
Well, then they would have done better at protecting people in care homes. My God, they've killed half of their voter base.
I mean, by the time people get to the care home stage, are they still voting? I mean, I know old people.
Yeah, they get shipped out don't they?
I mean, I suppose that could just be written off as a bit of incompetence, really. I don't know. I mean, well, you're sort of right.
It's really your compassion that comes through the strongest on this podcast, Jimmy.
Yeah, I mean, if you want compassion, go listen to the New Statesman podcast, I guess, or Navarra Media, perhaps. What?
I don't think they have very much compassion. I'll be completely honest. Speaking of Navarra Media and the New Statesman, look at me doing a Jimmy segue. So we've had a couple of weeks of Prime Minister's questions with the new Labour leader, Keir Starmer. Sorry, sir. Keir Starmer.
It's important to address him by his correct title, Jazza.
Of course, I'm so sorry. So Keir has managed to go head-to-head in the chamber in Prime Minister's Questions twice now with Boris Johnson, and we thought it would be a good time to check in and see how he is doing and what we think of his kind of performance since becoming the new Labour leader. There was a recent opinion research poll that currently had him at 42% approval and 18% disapproval. For comparison, Boris Johnson has a 46% approval and a 36% disapproval. So twice as high of disapproval, slightly higher approval ratings than Keir Starmer. Jimmy, have you been tuning into to Prime Minister's Questions?
I mean, again, you know, highlighting my strong commitment to doing research for this podcast, I have not watched either of Keir Starmer's appearances. So I'm aware that, you know, Boris Johnson was in the dispatch box and Keir Starmer phoned it in, which I think shows a lack of commitment to the cause, frankly. He should be down there in the front line exposing himself to the virus. I'm not being serious, just to clarify.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Thank you for clarifying. I suppose this will be my slight defence of my laziness, is I don't find Prime Minister's Questions very illuminating. I think I tuned into one or two of Jeremy Corbyn's performances against Theresa May. I don't think I saw any of his performances against Boris Johnson. Because the main audience is not really intended to be the public, it's intended to be the party, the MPs mostly. So, you know,
I would disagree. It's the MPs and the lobby, all of the political journalists who are based in Westminster.
Yeah, exactly.
Who then filter it out to the public. So it is quite important in that sense, but it isn't meant to be a prime time television show.
I mean, I think a lot of, I'm assuming that the main topic that Keir Starmer is challenging Boris Johnson on is his plans to kind of unwind lockdown at this stage and what he's been doing to protect people. And I think a lot of that messaging has filtered through. I think he's I mean, my impression is that he struck a relatively good balance between being supportive of, you know, the government in its intentions and being critical of what exactly it is doing, which seems to me to be the appropriate place for the opposition to be.
Yeah, it's there's been much made of Keir Starmer's Labour's constructive criticism approach, which, to be honest, has mainly come off as passive aggressive. So I have seen him. I have seen him perform at Prime Minister's Questions, and first, and there's a couple of things that are important to kind of note about this. First of all, is that it's a half. Oh, I mean, less than half. It's a sparse chamber now. There's almost nobody in it, and so the ruckus that would usually accompany that kind of event, that I think it would be safe to say would buoy someone like Boris Johnson, who rides the wave of kind of like a crowd quite well, his power there is diminished quite significantly. And Keir Starmer has, sorry, Sir Keir Starmer, has a background as a lawyer, is used to being in a courtroom, and without that crowd of jeering and of hear hears and all of that kind of stuff, it is like a courtroom. It's silent, it's solemn. And he looks really good. He has kind of like a slow, methodical, calm, plodding nature to the way that he questions Boris Johnson. The one kind of like passive-aggressive question that I really enjoyed from last week specifically was when he held up the graph that had been in every single daily briefing around COVID-19 that the government had done since lockdown happened. That compared the UK with with a number of other countries affected by the virus, he simply asked, on the day after the UK became the country with the highest death toll, he simply asked, "Well, why have you stopped including this slide that compares the UK with other countries? Why have you stopped including it in your briefings?" And then just sat back and waited. Waited for him to continue.
What was Johnson's answer to that?
Waffle, 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 waffle. It seems without that kind of like backdrop of several hundred MPs behind him, he's not able to hide in that energy. And so that him not answering a question is actually quite obvious now. I think a lot more obvious than it was when the chamber was full of people and it was this raucous thing. And people seem to... I think actually this is a representation of how good actually Prime Minister's Questions could be. It's often said that there's an awful lot of heat, not a lot of light at something like Prime Minister's Questions. That's one of the reasons probably that it doesn't have a huge amount of significance for a lot of people. But I think that this format that it has been forced to have has actually shown how useful this type of interrogation can be.
Well, I think the reason that I think actually you're wrong in the sense that what draws people to it is the fact that it is a bit of a theatre show. In its normal format where, you know, MPs are shouting at each other and jeering, it is kind of entertaining in a perverse way. It's not very illuminating, which was your point, which is definitely correct. I kind of think if you wanted to scrutinise the Prime Minister properly, you'd actually sit him in front of some sort of committee, basically, and allow, you know, people from, you know, different MPs to actually ask him proper questions.
And that does sometimes happen, but that's exactly what I mean, actually, is that I think the current format is a lot more like a committee hearing because it's one after another, it's one at a time, and you're less able to kind of like bat away those questions quite so easily. What do you think of Keir Starmer? Like, I have an interpretation that his style is very befitting for the formats and the times that he's found himself in. What have you thought of his leadership in general so far? Since he's appointed his shadow cabinet and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, I think part of the reason that he's been warmly received is that he's not Jeremy Corbyn, is kind of obvious thing, and he's also not I mean, his position on the position on how far left he is kind of a controversial one, but I think he's usually described as the soft left if you put Corbyn at the hard left.
I'll be honest, I don't really think that matters until they start drawing up a manifesto, really.
Maybe not, although I think it matters in the sense that I don't think Keir Starmer has as many dubious associations with some questionable people, let's say, as Corbyn did. But also stylistically, I think that Starmer, this is kind of linked to a point I made about you and Elizabeth Warren some podcasts ago, that Starmer actually flatters the prejudices of the average newspaper columnist, in the sense that he is kind of professional and well educated, has a respectable job, yada yada yada. Whereas Corbyn obviously rocked up in his donkey jacket or whatever. I'm talking about Michael Foot at this stage, but you know what I mean. Sort of walked up looking quite scruffy, and doesn't really. They're completely different people, I think. I think that's partly why Starmer's been well received. I mean, I also think.
But how have you received him?
I would be much happier about voting for Keir Starmer than I would have been Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, actually, as it stands, I would rather that Keir Starmer was the Prime Minister than Boris Johnson.
Yeah, me too.
But that probably just says more. I mean, the criticism I just shot at newspaper columnists probably applies to me. He sort of fits in with my preconceptions of what a prime minister should be like, but he seems more professional, and as a lawyer you have to be a details man, which Boris Johnson is definitely not. I think there are some downsides to that, but I personally warm is probably the wrong word. I think Keir Starmer would be a good prime minister, but actually he doesn't seem that likeable in a general sense, which I guess is one thing that Boris Johnson definitely has over him.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there is? I mean, so Boris Johnson has a disapproval rating of 36%, which is the highest of the three largest parties at Westminster. Nicola Sturgeon has a disapproval of 28. Keir Starmer has a disapproval of 18. Boris Johnson 36. Do you think that there's any danger of him, through mismanagement, maybe of the COVID-19 crisis? Do you think there's any damage of him being seen unfavourably among his Tory backbenchers, and therefore maybe being unsafe in his job? Maybe not. Maybe it's not during the crisis, because I think that would be a grave error to replace a prime minister in the middle of something like this. But do you see anything shaky there?
Well, I think that one of the slightly less commented on features of Boris Johnson's election victory in December was actually at that point he'd removed most of the true dissenters against Brexit, people who'd MPs who'd lost the party whip or quit the party or whatever. The Tory parliamentary party is now much more Brexity than it once was, and I think that's a huge factor in Johnson's favour.
But his performance right now, like, it was going to be defined for at least a couple of years on the exit of the European Union, whereas now it's defined on something that is completely different and shines a light on his competencies. Do you think that that's going to change anything, even though these new intakes and those who are more ideologically aligned with him on the European Union, even though they're with him on that particular issue, may they see somebody who's out of their depth? That's a leading question, if you've ever heard one, isn't it?
I mean, it is a leading question. I think Johnson is kind of out of his depth in having taken the job in the first place, and I don't think that was really an overriding concern. The reason that Tory MPs voted for Boris Johnson to be one of the final two in the leadership contest last year, and the reason that the Tory members voted for him, is because they think he's popular and can win elections. And yes, there are lots of people that really dislike Boris Johnson.
And to be fair, he did.
Well, yeah, he did. Yeah. So I think Boris Johnson is good to go, so long as the Tory party collectively, or MPs specifically, think that he can win the next general election, he'll be fine. Even if he is judged to have mishandled the coronavirus crisis. And at this stage, I mean, I think I'm still right in saying that the Tories are actually polling quite well.
Yeah, I believe recent polls still have them. Oh God, I see them around 50%.
Yeah,
50% in Westminster voting intention is pretty insane.
It is. I mean, it will. I think it will almost certainly be lower by the time the general election rolls around.
That's 2025. Jesus.
Well, at least
2024 more likely.
Probably 2024. They've already started repealing the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, so he'll be able to call a general election when he likes.
So whenever. Very exciting for everyone involved.
This was something I actually looked at on the website, and actually a surprising number of sitting prime ministers, about a third, actually don't end up running in the next general election, which is quite high. I know that, you know, Boris Johnson has a reasonable size majority for what period
of time?
Back until 1918.
That's a really interesting stat. Well done.
Yeah. And I can't remember what the average tenure of a prime minister is. I think it might be around 6 years or something like that.
Interesting.
I don't know. When you look at the sort of wider picture, actually, you know, Boris Johnson's going to have been in office for, let's say it's 2025 for the sake of argument, he's going to have been in office for like 6 years at that point. The Shard is definitely going to come off his premiership.
Yeah.
And
how interesting, because we're so used to long-term prime ministers. Like, what was it, 11, 12 years of Thatcher, a very long time under...
10 years with Blair.
Yeah, even seven, 8 years with John Major.
I think the long-term ones are the ones that stick in the mind, and they're the ones that actually have a chance to properly transform the country.
That's fair.
The ones that sort of flip in and out of office, like Theresa May... You know, probably won't be that well remembered in 20 years' time. And if she is remembered, it will be for her, you know, the Brexit thing. But then, you know, it was Boris Johnson that actually, quote unquote, delivered Brexit. So really, Theresa May is just a fairly inconsequential stopgap, really.
Bless her.
No offense.
Imagine.
No offense, Terry. I think there's a much larger chance of Boris Johnson not running in the next general election or losing than actually people are chalking up at the moment.
How interesting. I've not thought of him not running before.
Well, if people feel that, you know, I mean, a lot of people chattering on Twitter are, you know, saying there'll be a public inquiry and, you know, various people have found to have cocked up. It seems a given now that the UK is going to have the largest death toll from the COVID-19 crisis in Europe anyway. You know, that stuff's not good for them. Nothing ever really comes of those public inquiries anyway. They don't, you know, people, by the time that they're actually published, people generally know who's to blame, if anyone's to blame. And I think a lot, you know, the public don't necessarily have that long a memory of things. I mean, do we even think that Brexit is going to be a big issue by the time the next general election happens? And, you know, for 3 years, it consumed the soul of the nation. I don't know.
Oh, mate, just you wait.
Just you wait, you think it's going to be an issue?
Yeah.
Okay. We managed to bring this back.
So I just saw some polling. I was scrolling through the Britain Elects Twitter feed, and YouGov polling shows that it's 50% of the UK want the transition period to be extended, against about 30-35% who don't want it to be extended.
So the transition period currently is to the end of this year, isn't it? Is that correct?
I believe it has to be formally extended by the end of July, I believe.
And currently there's a bit of a freeze-on between the negotiators of the UK and the EU.
Yeah.
I was reading.
The EU are like, what the fuck are you on about, mate? Just extend it, you twat.
Yeah. This was something actually, bringing it back to what we're supposed to be talking about. Keir Starmer seems to have actually slightly let the Brexit thing go at this stage, which is interesting given that he was
Remainers. Funnily enough, Jimmy, probably not front of mind at the minute.
Probably not, but as I was saying, given that it was such a big deal for everyone, do you envision that after the coronavirus is sort of contained in some way that he's going to pick up the issue again?
Yeah, potentially, but I think it's so much out of his hands. And also, he is probably the individual who was running for the leadership who was most likely to kind of let the Tory party own that. in terms of the transition to leaving the EU. Oh, but what if we get another referendum? Anyway,
don't start.
Shall
again.
We move on to Adele and her ever diminishing waistline? That's a very demeaning way to introduce her. I'm so sorry.
Is there a nice way to introduce this topic, I think, that doesn't offend somebody
Adele
somewhere?
Posted something about a 30-second from her 30-second birthday, and she's lost a lot of weight. Some say about 7 stone, probably.
Source is familiar with the matter. So
about seven. Her scales stone, are on record.
Five
saying...
ounces, I would say. Had to okay. guess.
Thanks for eyeballing that for us, Jimmy. We appreciate it. There was, oh my god, right, I'd never, Christ. So she is a lot thinner, that she's known for being kind of like a more average normal built lady. She's bigger, curvier than a lot of people that you generally see on the charts, like say a Jessie J or a Dua Lipa, for example.
Sure. Yeah.
And for a long time she was celebrated for that. She recently went through a divorce, which can't be a fun time. And she hasn't been posting very much on social media. And then she posted this photo of what some people are calling a revenge bod.
I think she's just had a baby as well, I was reading.
I think that was a while ago. That was before the breakup.
Ah, okay, she's recently had a baby. This is what her personal trainer says.
Oh, okay, cool.
This is real news, Jazza.
What website are you reading?
Today.
I'm so happy that is now on your search history.
I mean, it's mostly tanks and missiles, so... To be honest, this is a serious step up as far as Google's concerned.
So a lot of the traditional tabloids, including Today... were like, oh my god, she looks amazing, look at that revenge bod, oh she's doing so well, well done Adele, lovely, good. And she but then there was a big pushback of how we talk about women's bodies when they lose weight. Is it appropriate to talk about women's bodies like this when they lose weight? Lots of people got very heated on Twitter about it. Jimmy, I know you're chomping at the bit and have strong opinions on this. What is your take on the way that we've ended up talking about Adele losing about 7 stone and, what was it, 5 ounces?
I mean, that was just a figure I made up. It's not a real figure.
I know it was. I was running with the joke, but you know what? Feel free to. I was
worried for a second that you thought I had some sort of superpower whereby I can size up how much weight someone's lost just by comparing two photos. That is not, in fact, the case. Just want to clarify. The reason I suggested this topic is because somebody was saying, like, Adele's always been attractive and you're fat phobic, quote unquote, if you think otherwise. I think some people have kind of lost the plot a little bit. I'm not saying, you know.
Go on. How come? Why do you think that?
Well, because, you know, some people look better at different weights. I'm not saying that everyone, and, you know, different people find people attractive at different weights. So there's some people that probably thought Adele was much more attractive before she lost the weight, I'm assuming. Are they like skinny phobic for no longer finding her attractive? I don't know. I mean, I do know they're obviously not. It's just like opinions, isn't it? You can't, I mean, Jazza, you know as anyone that you can't control what gives you a boner.
Jesus.
Well, that is true, isn't it? I mean, that is what we're talking about here, basically.
Oh, wow. Okay, so can I ask a question about the person who, obviously not giving away the identity, but was the person who made that comment that she was much more attractive when she was heavier, was that a straight man or a queer woman?
Well, he didn't say she was more attractive when she was heavier. He said he implied that she was just as attractive, and it was... I don't know if it was a straight man. I guess it was a straight man. It must have been, or at least a bisexual man. It was a man who was attracted to ladies.
A man who was attracted to ladies.
Let's go with that.
I kind of hate the assumption that somebody loses weight in order to be more attractive to other people. Obviously, that's going to be something that plays into it. But frankly, and actually, I think some of the blowback of people saying congratulations for losing weight to Adele is probably overplayed. But there is some truth to us not necessarily knowing what has caused her weight loss, whether it's deliberate or whether it's from a personal trainer, or whether
a personal trainer was involved. So I'm guessing it was deliberate.
But there could be. We don't know that. We didn't know that. Until all of the her doctor has also done an interview with Hello magazine. I'm like, for goodness sake, where does the professionalism end?
Where does it begin?
Here, right here. So I can't help but approach it as someone who's had and still like has like issues with eating disorders and kind of like weight problems, and I having gone through and still am going through loads of kind of like body dysmorphia and all of that kind of stuff, I never comment on their weight or how skinny they look or how fat they look. That doesn't mean I don't say you look great. That doesn't mean I don't say that your makeup is amazing or I think that your dress looks really great on you and all of those kinds of things. But I'm really aware from being on the receiving end of it, that the words that people say about you, to you, even when it's a compliment, can really throw you in a spin. Because they throw me in a spin. When people have said that you've lost weight, I'm like, oh Christ, how big was I before? Or whatever. I'm obviously somebody who has a particular issue around it.
Yeah.
And so that's not going to be universal. But because of that, I have completely scrubbed that quite normal thing that we do in our society of complimenting people on weight loss. I've completely scrubbed that from my vernacular and how I talk to people. And I'd like it if people did that more. Obviously there is a tabloid culture that objectifies women and talks about women who lose weight, put on weight, have cellulite, get work done, etc., etc., and that's probably not one of the nicer parts of our society. And I think also that there's a little bit of a pain in losing an advocate for bigger women and confident bigger women who are incredibly talented and the top of their game and the best-selling artists of their generation.
I mean, was she
who
an
didn't
advocate?
Need to say again,
was she an advocate?
Yeah, she was on the front page of she's done interviews when she was younger, when she was releasing, I think, 21, her second album. She's done interviews where she was like, I don't look like a normal pop star, and I don't want to look like a normal pop star. I don't see images of me having my tits out on a magazine, etc., etc., etc.
Right.
So she has, like, advocated and at least given the outward impression of being proud of not being conventionally sized of what we'd expect kind of like a pop star to look like. And I think that there is probably a little bit of a mourning of that kind of a role model for people who are a little bit bigger.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. But I do wish that how we address people by saying, oh, you look great, you look fantastic now that you've lost the weight and that kind of stuff. I wish that weren't something that we talked about.
I think that the trouble is while I do see where you're coming from, I think generally when people lose a significant amount of weight, it is reasonable to assume that it's been deliberate. I mean, there are obviously medical reasons why someone might suddenly lose weight for reasons that are not deliberate, if you know somebody was intending to lose the weight and then they lost the weight. I think that
part of the problem is that's an assumption. People lose weight because they're sick. People lose weight because they're stressed. People lose weight because they have eating disorders.
That's true, but I mean,
and I think that happens. Those things that happen that then cause weight loss are more common than we probably think, because we have an assumption of kind of like the fact that people go on diets and go training and stuff. And often those things, there's kind of like a crossover of all of those things sometimes, perhaps.
I mean, I think as you were talking, I realized that I generally don't comment on people's weight. Unless it's a friend to insult them. I have to admit, I do that all the time. But I think it's a bit weird. Listeners won't know this, but I'm quite a skinny guy, and for some reason it sort of is seen as acceptable to just say, "Oh, you're really skinny," which I think is quite personal, to be honest. I'm not gonna pull my heart out over this, but I think it is slightly odd just to say to somebody something like that. I've now just completely contradicted what I previously said, but I'm okay with that. I mean, some people might be quite self-conscious about how skinny they are and might want to put on more weight, potentially.
Like 100%, it can go both ways.
But I mean, I sort of, to go back to my original position, I see why people do it, and I think generally in life, I think you have to take, comments in the manner they're intended rather than, or you have to assume that they're generously meant,
100%.
right?
Oh, like I agree. When people have said stuff like that to me, I know that they don't mean it in a bad way, but you can't stop what your brain does with that. With the way that somebody perceives you. I just wish that we made it more normal to just not say that. Obviously, soy boy, blah blah blah, whatever. But like that kind of language can be triggering, and I say that as somebody who is triggered by that language, still all the time.
No, I see your position entirely. I mean, the only other thing I would say against what you've generally said is that I think there's a certain amount of denial that there is like a there. I mean, there is kind of an ideal or like a series of ideals, and those ideals do tend to be. I mean, it's like the Love Island bodies, let's say. That's kind of seen as the ideal, and pretending that people don't find that attractive seem or like. I'm not saying people exclusively find that attractive, but there's a reason why those are the sort of bodies you see in pornography or glamour modeling or whatever,
Yeah,
right?
but then also I think that we get conditioned to a certain extent to finding that attractive. I found it incredibly liberating, and it was like a real kind of light bulb moment for me when I realized that I found people attractive who didn't look like the body ideal that I was seeking. And I guess that's specifically a phenomenon for somebody who's attracted to somebody of the same sex as them, and we have a lot more that can really affect us because of the fact that we can compare our bodies and all of that kind of stuff. But when I realized and allowed myself to find people who didn't look like all of the people that I'd seen in the magazines and the pornos, attractive, and like that was genuinely really revolutionary to me and made me kind of like care about it more, care about it less. I will say also, I think that women especially have a completely, like it's another level of exposure to this kind of language where it's almost very often for some women, it's akin to a hello. Like, hello, you've lost weight. And especially as kind of like a famous woman with like nearly 40 million followers on Instagram, what a weird position for Adele to be in. She like There must have been a realization and a knowledge that posting that image on her 32nd birthday was going to get some kind of traction around the
Well,
amount of weight that she had lost.
she looks very different. It doesn't.
Yeah, she
It,
yeah
it's
she
not.
she doesn't look the same.
I mean, I don't think if I'd just seen the image, I don't think I'd have recognised her.
Yeah,
It was
same.
only because I saw the image in the
Yeah,
context
she
of,
so she must she must have known. But still, God, it must be like ripping off a band-aid.
Yeah, I mean, this.
Like knowing that you have to go through this. I mean, even we're bloody talking about it. It was your fault. You chose it.
You love this topic. I have the messages to prove it.
Yeah,
Probably.
fair. Yeah.
And it has been interesting, I think. I feel like we've come to a nice agreement on this of
Oh,
sorts,
I'm
maybe.
glad you think so.
It's been very wholesome, I think.
Good. We've had peaks, we've had full narratives.
And we've managed to discuss something that isn't purely related to the Westminster bubble or COVID-19 or Brexit. So
Oh my God, look at us. I'm really proud.
I think we're growing as people.
Actually, I've started uploading stuff that has nothing to do with that on YouTube at the moment. So if you want to watch that, go over to my YouTube channel. I've uploaded stuff on the Eurovision Song Contest. Somehow I managed to not have that as a topic this year. But you know what, 2021 will come around the corner very soon.
I was thinking, I think Eurovision is probably one of our... It's probably in the top 10 most discussed things, I think.
Somewhere. Oh, it's easily top 10. Jimmy, it might even be top 3.
I mean, Brexit has to hit the top rank, I think, or Brexit-related topics. I mean,
Brexit, Islamophobia because of your bloody obsession, and then Eurovision is probably the top 3.
I think you're overstating the Islamophobia topics. Uh-huh.
Somebody go through and code all 156 episodes. Go on, Ade.
I mean, we've now done a fatphobia topic, so I feel we're broadening our content. That's important in terms of the strategy.
Okay, Jimmy, where can they find you on the internet if they want to further dive into the depths of your mind?
I wouldn't recommend it. It's, you can find me at JDE Nichols on Twitter. I'm sort of occasionally posting stuff on the website and other sites as well.
Yeah, his writing's quite good.
There you go. Even though my opinions are terrible, they're very, very nicely written.
Yeah, they're written down quite beautifully. And you can find me at Jazza John. And if you want to find me anywhere on the internet, you can find me by typing in Jazza John.
Because no one is called Jazza, because it's not a real name.
No, there is. No, Jimmy, don't you poke this wound. There's a guy in Australia called Josiah who has like 2 million subscribers who does drawing videos, and he goes by the name Jazza on YouTube. His URL is youtube.com/Jazza.
I mean, he's just better at SEO than you are, mate. Just don't take it personal. Walk it off.
It's very annoying. Anyway.
Okay,
shall we go now? Bye.
That's enough, I think.
Okay, good.
Bye-bye.